Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. Lately, Chinese authorities are increasingly flirting with the prominent actors in Afghan politics. They are in talks both with the Afghan authorities and people close to the Taliban leadership. At the same time, Beijing is in good terms both with Kabul and Islamabad, and recent efforts by Chinese authorities show that they also want Pakistani and Afghan leaders to work together. The question is, what is in it for China? Are these efforts making any difference? I guess even the bigger question is, what is that the Pakistani and Afghan authorities can't agree on? So it's a huge topic, but I have confidence in today's panel to deal with all these questions in coming 30 minutes. So without further ado, let's welcome our guests from Kabul. I'm joined by Sona Engel Rasmussen, The Guardian's correspondent covering Afghanistan and Pakistan. From London, Hamid Hakimi is joining us, who's an Afghan scholar at the Chatham House. And from Prague, Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, is joining us. The site looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Gentlemen, welcome to the Gandhara.
Thank you.
Very
Thank
nice you. To have you. So, Sone, let's start this with recent developments. Though it's not really recent, but in the light of recent efforts by Chinese authorities to calm down tension between Pakistan and Afghanistan, any immediate outcome of recent Chinese shuttle diplomacy?
No, and there's not been an immediate outcome. We've also seen China a year ago, or a year and a half ago, try to play an increased diplomatic role with the Taliban. They offered to hold talks in China, and they've sort of been trying to assume a more role as a mediator between the Taliban and the Pakistani government. So far, we haven't seen that really pay off yet. But as you say, it's also not necessarily a new thing. I mean, if you look at it in a historical perspective, China has for decades tried to be sort of a friend in need for Pakistan, when Pakistan feels pressured on other sides. I mean, we saw in the 1960s when the U.S. increased military aid to India, and Pakistan got very frustrated with this relationship with the U.S., and China appeared as sort of an alternative ally to Pakistan. And I think that's some of the same pattern that we see now. There is a lot of frustration in Pakistan with its relationship with the U.S., a lot of uncertainty also after President Trump came into power. So I think we should see it in that perspective also, China trying to show Pakistan that if they are interested in nurturing different alliances beyond the economic alliance that is already very strong between the two countries, so then they are certainly willing to play a stronger diplomatic role.
As Sona said, Abu Bakr, it's not new that China is engaging with the Afghan politics. Earlier, they were also, in this or the other way, were engaged with the peace process. I heard the Taliban representatives were taken to China for talks, etc. Is it an indication of increasing interest by China in Afghan affairs?
Yeah, exactly. I think we have to understand Chinese role in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We don't really necessarily need to look at the past. We really need to look towards the future. And what I mean by that is that China is investing a lot of money. China is now working on this huge, which is essentially is the Chinese grand strategy, the One Road, One Belt. One major project of that great scheme is what the Chinese call is the New Silk Road, is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is 50 billion plus investments in Pakistan to link Western China, or not Western Chinese province of Xinjiang, to the Arabian Sea and the Middle East. So for China, I think there are two or three main core interests. Number one is this economic interest, and then its security interest. Yeah. China wants to integrate Xinjiang, which is a predominantly Muslim region, mostly populated by Turkic ethnic groups. The biggest one, of course, are the Uyghurs, into China by a kind of bringing development, industry, infrastructure, investments, and also to explore energy resources in Western, in that region. And for that, China also want to, needs to develop all of Xinjiang's neighboring regions, which includes Central Asia, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. And in Afghanistan in particular, and also in Pakistan, China has one core security interest, because some of the Uyghur separatists who are mobilized in the name of Islam, ETIM, which was the main Uyghur separatist group, has been using sanctuaries in Afghanistan and Pakistan for the past more than two decades. The first emerged during the Taliban stint in power in Afghanistan in the 90s. So China wants to prevent kind of a Chechnya-like insurgency in Xinjiang, and for that, finding lasting stability in Afghanistan and Pakistan and between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and some kind of an end to Taliban insurgencies in both countries is, I think, is in Chinese interest.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Hakimi, in your opinion, what China's after in Afghanistan?
I mean, I agree with both colleagues on their analysis. I would also add, just generally looking at the history of post-2001 Afghanistan and China's relations, what I see new, at least as claimed by the Afghan government, is that the Afghans under Ashraf Ghani particularly believe that they have built a sense of confidence with the Chinese, and they're increasingly putting this narrative out that they think that the Chinese are not looking at Afghanistan anymore through the lens of the Pakistanis, which for Afghans have always been a problem. So in terms of the overall what has changed and post 2001, I think all these economic aspirations by China is obviously of a lot of relevance to this whole picture. I think it's very difficult to say specifically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and these are the exact Chinese interests and hence China's behavior in the recent months. But what you, because Chinese are not actually very vocal about, unlike, for example, the Western governments, they're not very vocal about what their interests are, and sometimes the interest may be quite different to what is being portrayed. But I certainly believe that as the U.S.'s role is changing, and we're all kind of waiting on the Trump administration to see what kind of a vacuum or what kind of a role it's going to play in Afghanistan, it is natural that it will be filled by more powerful neighbors of Afghanistan like China and Russia. And
okay,
but to give you like this vague total picture.
Yeah, in a big picture, as we discussed so far, China seems to be engaged with all players. How are they seen on the ground? What I mean is that China's increasing role is not seen very positively in Afghanistan's neighbors. In Central Asia, for instance, you have seen huge protests in Kazakhstan. There is some sort of resentment in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan against their increasing rule. How do Afghan people look into that?
China actually is rarely mentioned as a big concern for ordinary Afghan people. I think they're used to having a lot of global powers trying to interfere in their affairs. I mean, there were some rumors that are completely unconfirmed, but rumors nonetheless that there were Chinese forces in eastern Afghanistan last year. And I think the reason those rumors might sort of be circling around into some sectors of Kabul and the political establishment here is that maybe some people are worried that China might take a more active interest militarily in Afghanistan as my colleagues also mentioned earlier, because of the Uyghurs. But China is not seen as one of the major players here. There are many countries that are much more deeply involved, including in supporting the Taliban. I'm not just talking about Pakistan, also Russia and Iran. I think people's eyes are more on them. To the extent that people do talk about China, it is in relation to Pakistan, where China is now a bigger economic partner than even the United States. And I think that in itself is something that people are curious about here, maybe also watching with some concern. But China is not a country that's sort of at the forefront of people's minds here.
Okay. Let's expand that a little bit, the original concern. How does the Chinese objectives or efforts marry those of Pakistan, maybe more importantly of India, of Russia, of the United States, Abu Bakr?
Well, I think just sticking to the specific question of Afghanistan-Pakistan relations, we have to remember that since 2014, I mean, the Chinese role has grown, it's become more prominent. And this is, I think, quite a big shift for a country that's traditionally against interfering in the domestic affairs of other countries, that has a foreign policy that's very different from, I mean, what we have seen in the West, Western foreign policies since the Second World War, after the Second World War. So if you look back in 2014, China appointed a special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan when Western forces were withdrawing from Afghanistan. China is also, I mean, there are, I acknowledge the difficulties in implementing those investments, but China is still, on paper at least, the biggest foreign investor in Afghanistan. And the future of its One Road, One Belt will be affected by the outcome of the war in Afghanistan. So at least under the Obama's administration, there was this realization that Washington and China need to work together to bring stability to Afghanistan. We should not forget that they had formed a kind of an informal contact group in which Chinese, Afghan, and U.S. officials could meet and exchange views. And then, of course, China has also reached out to Taliban. I think one little noticed shift has been in Chinese attitude towards Pakistan. China and Pakistan, as we have discussed, are traditional allies. Pakistan and China both are very fond and proud of their friendship, which they think is really deep and which is somehow also aimed at their mutual rival, India. But I think we have seen a very visible attempt on part of China to convey to its allies in Islamabad and Rawalpindi, the Pakistani military, that militancy of the Taliban kind might not have a bright future in this region. After all, the Chinese will not be investing $50 billion to build a major rail and road network to connect Western China to the Taliban headquarters in southwestern Pakistani province of Balochistan. So we have seen in recent years, in post-World War history, I mean, in recent history, that a lot of security interests are guided by economic interests. So the Chinese interests are being guided by economic interests. I think in terms of Afghanistan, Chinese role is stabilizing by and large. And we have seen, for example, in recent months, in June, the Chinese foreign minister visited Pakistan and kind of made this very visible attempt to bring Pakistan, broker some kind of a thaw in the relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which are fraught. Under Chinese encouragement, which was later on followed on by a delegation of U.S. senators just this month, Afghanistan and Pakistan agreed on kind of coordinating anti-militant operations across their joint border. Now, again, there are many issues and many challenges in materializing and implementing that kind of cooperation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, final question before we get into the break. Mr. Hakimi, India has a huge interest in Afghanistan, China being a Pakistan ally, and China, India not being a really good friendly terms. How does the Chinese role or increasing role in Afghanistan playing out in India and Pakistan-India tension in Afghanistan? Isn't this making things even more complicated in Afghanistan?
I mean, it is, but for me, the role of India in Afghanistan is often overplayed. I mean, India, at the end of the day, does not share a border with Afghanistan. And, of course, there is a huge amount of, I would say, an emotional attachment to Afghanistan's friendship with India. But in terms of the Chinese role in Afghanistan being an issue within India domestically, I don't think it really rates high there. I mean, India is concerned more with the relationship of China with Pakistan rather than Chinese role in Afghanistan.
Okay, thank you very much for this. Talking about China or other regional actors, it's yet to be seen what difference will their efforts make? But even the bigger question, I think, is what is that Pakistan and Afghanistan can't agree on? Why can't they reach to some sort of settlement, if not to become friends, at least to work together? What has to happen so that they cooperate? We will continue the discussion, discussing this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara Podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective, and the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Gandhara podcast, we are discussing endless tension between Pakistan and Afghanistan, reasons and possible solutions. Joining me in the discussion are Sonia Engel Rasmussen, Kabul-based reporter for The Guardian, covering Pakistan and Afghanistan, Hamid Hakimi, an Afghan scholar at the London-based think tank Chatham House, and Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen, to the Gandhara podcast. So in this part, let's try to take a microscopic look into tension between these two neighbors from their own local perspective. Blame games are aside at the times of tension. What is that these two countries can't overcome and talk through things that they have fundamental difference on? It's a big question. Again, let's start with you, Sonny.
Well, where to start? I mean, as many of us probably remember, President Ashraf Ghani, when he won the election back in 2014, one of his first big diplomatic gambles was to try and sweeten relations with Pakistan and try to reach out and make new diplomatic efforts to get Pakistan to convince the Taliban to get to come to the negotiating table, and that failed spectacularly in the weeks and months after his first attempts. There were some very bad attacks some very ugly attacks in Afghanistan, including in Kabul, and he immediately received a very harsh political backlash. And it's proven simply too politically costly for Ghani domestically to reach out to Pakistan in that way. And I think the mistrust among not just people here, but also among the political establishment and people in the political elite who can act as spoilers for Ghani's government runs very, very deep. And of course, it does on both sides of the border, where there seems to be very little recognition of one's own role in fomenting insurgency in the other country. By that, I mean, of course, in Afghanistan, everybody sees the Taliban as an extension of the Pakistani military and of the ISI. But on the other side of the border, the Pakistanis also see Afghanistan as deliberately fomenting insurgency via the Pakistani Taliban. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement, even in private conversations, actually, with a lot of, there are some exceptions, but generally, there doesn't seem to be a lot of acknowledgement of one's own role in destabilizing the neighboring country. And I think that's obviously one big obstacle that doesn't seem to be, it seems pretty intractable at this point. And I think it takes a lot of political courage on either side of the border to be able to approach each other, because it simply is so politically costly at the moment. We've even seen people around the Afghan government sort of break with the government in protest very quickly over Ashraf Ghani's attempts to build bridges to Pakistan. So I think we need to see the movement in the political establishments before anything else.
Abu Bakr, so I think it's a right spot to get into another really fundamental question here. So how does the ideal Afghanistan looks like from Islamabad's point of view?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask this question to in Islamabad. I think for most civilian politicians, for the civilian government, they want a stable Afghanistan, and they do realize that Afghanistan is a sovereign country entitled to fashioning its domestic affairs in whatever way the Afghan people like. But we have to be realistic here. I mean, no, as a journalist, we are supposed to report facts, and facts are truth. So the truth here is that for the past 40 years, four decades, Pakistan has attempted to fashion domestic Afghan politics through covert warfare, proxies. The current form of proxies, of course, the Taliban or the Taliban's deadly military wing, the Haqqani network. And that is where the real sticking point is. I know that there are some Pakistani militants hiding in Afghanistan. Maybe it's possible that somebody in Afghanistan or another country is helping them in some way. But compared to the Afghan Taliban and the threat they pose to the Afghan government, this is a very small threat. So, I mean, the best way to look at this is to understand Pakistani military thinking, which is somehow still stuck in the Cold War. Pakistani military sees Afghanistan as an extension of Indian influence and power. Having researched this issue quite a lot and written about it extensively for decades and coming from the country, I think there is a mindset issue. Most people that I have talked to are not ready to acknowledge that Afghanistan is a sovereign country. And I think unless that thinking changes in Islamabad and Rawalpindi, we won't see any real progress towards stable relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan and cooperation between the two countries. We should not forget that the two countries are unique in the sense that they share a lot. The major ethnic group in Afghanistan, Pashtuns, there are more Pashtuns in Pakistan. For every Afghan Pashtuns, there are two Pakistani Pashtuns. So there are tremendous scope for building trust and friend relations between Afghanistan and Pakistan. But in recent decades, and particularly now, it's threatened by this kind of support through proxies and covert warfare and endless blame game.
Right. So, Abu Bakr, just a follow-up question on that. You also hinted during your comments that there are certain people who really like to see a stable Afghanistan, but there is another group which really doesn't recognize, or at least doesn't want to recognize, sovereign Afghanistan. It appears that the last group is the makers and shakers from what we hear from Pakistan and Afghanistan. So how far Pakistan can go to follow the strategy it believes the correct strategy, at least from these makers and shakers' point of view in Afghanistan?
Well, I think they've shown that they can go really very far. I mean, in the sense that we have witnessed and we're still witnessing, there was just one suicide attack yesterday, a major Taliban and Al-Qaeda insurgency in Pakistan. And Al-Qaeda and the Taliban didn't arise in a vacuum. They didn't come to Pakistan out of nowhere. Their presence in Pakistan was the consequence of Pakistani support for these kind of elements for decades. So, it looks like a cycle, but I think the cycle can break once the thinking in Pakistan towards Afghanistan changes.
Interesting.
I have to add that we can blame Afghans for all things that have gone wrong in their country and they're responsible for. But after all, Afghanistan didn't backstab Pakistan during its many wars with India. For example, in 1965 and 1971, when Pakistan was very vulnerable, Afghanistan didn't backstab Pakistan.
Okay. Mr. Hakimi, do you want to add something to what Abu Bakr has said? Otherwise, we move on with the other questions.
I totally agree with what he said. I think, unfortunately, the issue of Pakistan-Afghanistan, you know, relations has become such an emotional baggage now in Afghanistan. It's like a coal that you touch as a politician, and you could be labeled so many bad things, both by media and by public perception in Afghanistan, if you're deemed as friendly with Pakistan. So unfortunately, because Pakistan has not been able to reciprocate the very public outreach of the Afghan government, you know, with tangible, verifiable sense of cooperation, and at least in terms of security and helping with the Taliban threat, the public perception of Afghanistan has increasingly hardened. And also there's been a generational shift in the last 15 years in Afghanistan. The fact that the country is very young, without prolonging that data explanation, you know, you have a young generation who has no experience of living in Pakistan and sees Pakistan as this, you know, harboring terrorist nation. And the distinctions between the state and society and the military and the civilian, at least in the public perception of Afghanistan, is unfortunately diminishing. And that is a very dangerous thing to experience in the long term, because then it actually reduces the sense of cooperation. So I think we have to highlight that as a major sticking point as we go into future. And I hope things do get better, but if they don't, unfortunately, we will go to a massive generational shift in Afghanistan that would be extremely anti-Pakistan, and then we'd be dealing with a major, you know, further emotional problem that it would take decades to resolve.
Mm. I understand that, Mr. Hakimi, but when we look from the other aspect, so whether true or just the product of imagination, Pakistan has certain interpretation of what's happening in Afghanistan and therefore has certain worries, concerns. And it appears that Islamabad's view won't change unless it is concerns are not addressed in Afghanistan. So what can be done on that to address that? What can Afghanistan do on this?
I mean, I've had the privilege of being in Islamabad and, you know, elsewhere, speaking to really sort of elite Pakistani political and other, you know, delegations and people, private conversations and all sorts. I think the entire mindset of the Pakistani hardcore, I would say old school Pakistani political and military elite together is that somehow Afghanistan will go back to 1991, 1992, and there will be a civil war, that the government in Kabul will collapse at some point because it's aid dependent, it's corrupt, that it's got infighting, it's got all the issues that you can, you know, clearly see in Pakistan's civilian government as well. But obviously the Pakistani mindset at the elite level is that when that happens and this whole thing hits the roof, we are the neighbors. We have to have a plan B. And the plan B is that we have to have some guys out there to protect our borders, to have some leverage, to make sure that they doesn't come into our borders and our country. And I think as a state like Pakistan, which is huge compared to Afghanistan, it has aspirations that within those aspirations, Afghanistan is seen as a problem rather than as an opportunity. I think those, from an independent perspective, I would say it is somehow legitimate that has not been, you know, facilitated under an independent platform to have a conversation about between Pakistanis and Afghans. Afghans have always had the narrative of Pakistan harboring Taliban, which true, of course, there are elements within the Pakistani establishment that we all know about, it, established facts that support the Taliban, you know, and they're vocal about it. So, I mean, the narrative between Afghanistan and Pakistan has never gone beyond, you know, you support our bad guys, and the Pakistanis say, well, you support our bad guys, and you've created this vacuum for India to come and have 20 or 18 or whatever number of embassies and stations to destabilize Pakistan. So, you know, it's been kind of back and forth. And the international community, I would say particularly the American, I don't know how much of that opportunity exists now, but to kind of dwell a bit in the past, I think there was opportunity for the Americans as the main supporter in terms of economics, both to Pakistan and Afghanistan, to kind of create a kind of a bridge that would have settled some of these fears. Pakistan thinks that Afghanistan, at one point or another, within the decade, within 5 years, within a year, it will collapse. And, you know, I think that is a main concern that they have, and it's within their psyche, it's in their system. And just last point, I think within the wider Pakistani society, their interaction with Afghanistan in the last 20, 30 years has generally been through seeing Afghan refugees on their streets, disenfranchised Afghan refugees living in tents and living in quarters, completely disenfranchised human beings, could be blamed for anything because they don't have any stake in society. So the Pakistani public generally is quite susceptible and receptive to an explanation by their elites where they can blame Afghanistan for their problem. I think that's what, for me, that's the sticking point in Pakistan.
Mm. Okay, let's try to look into the situation through a little bit optimistic lenses towards end of our discussion, Sone. So what are the steps which proved useful so far in calming down tension between these two countries?
Thank you for leaving me with the task of being the optimist on the program. I mean, I think, honestly, if we look at the past 3 years in Afghanistan, I don't see a lot of silver linings in the situation. I think, but one thing we've forgotten to talk about here is the role that the regional powers or the global powers play in Afghanistan. And without them, I don't think we'll find a solution to the Afghan conflict. Of course, Pakistan is one player, China is second, but we also have Russia, and we particularly have Iran, and we have the US. And the attitude that you have from the U.S. now is that they appear to be openly gearing up for a long-term, if not permanent, presence in Afghanistan. And that's, of course, something that people have been talking about for many years, that the U.S. wanted to. But we saw an unusually candid op-ed in the Wall Street Journal recently by General David Petraeus, where he basically called the struggle in Afghanistan a generational struggle, and insinuating that we should not expect the U.S. to pull out in 4 years or even maybe in a decade. And I think that creates a lot of mistrust in the region, and it basically confirms what people, for example, in Tehran or in Moscow have been worried about. And there they are not willing to accept a permanent American military presence in Afghanistan. And as long as their concerns are not being met somehow and assuaged somehow, I think it's very difficult to convince them not to support the insurgency. And that goes for Pakistan as well. And Pakistan, well, you asked before also whether the onus is of what Afghanistan could do to accommodate Pakistan's concerns. But I think actually the onus is more on Islamabad. And one concern that the Pakistanis have is India's presence in Afghanistan. And to a certain extent, to a large extent, those concerns, I think, are exaggerated. You don't have an Indian military presence in Afghanistan. You don't see any attempts from India to, at least at the moment, to establish a military presence that could threaten Pakistan. So I guess to go back to your question about what there is to be optimistic about, then I think if you want me to mention something positive, I think we have to look at more sort of isolated things in Afghanistan. I think the Afghan government is doing a reasonable job at taking first steps to root out corruption. It's pretty early on, and we haven't seen a lot of results yet, but I think it's genuine about in its efforts. We've seen the more soldiers being trained, and we've seen parts of the security forces, far from the entire security force, but parts of the security forces strengthening and getting an upper hand when they're being deployed, for example, the special forces. So, you know, the more capable the Afghan government becomes in handling the insurgency itself, the closer you also get to resolution here. But I think politically and regionally, the way things are moving now seems to be towards more or an even more intractable conflict than it is now, unfortunately. I know that's not what you want to hear, but
let me try Abubakar on this. So Abubakar, is it conceivable at all that these two countries might not be best friends, but at least they can work together? And what role can regional powers play in this?
Well, I think it's really conceivable and it's ultimately needed. And I think luckily elites in both countries know that and realize that. I mean, we are living in the 21st century and people are really closely connected. We are not like living in different planets or spheres. I think both in Pakistan, if you talk to politicians primarily, because, I mean, it's very difficult to openly talk to some of the other folks involved with security and stuff, issues like that, they realize that ultimately there has to be some kind of settlement between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the two countries need to sort out a lot of stuff. I think the major focus right now is, and this was the focus of the Chinese effort, is to jumpstart some kind of a counterterrorism cooperation between the two countries. Now, the two countries have very different objectives and aims from what they call counterterrorism and who their respective terrorists are. For example, just last week, Pakistani Foreign Office said that Afghanistan needs to offer incentives to the Afghan Taliban so the Afghan Taliban can join in a peace process. I mean, if Afghanistan would have suggested the same thing, I'm sure that many in Pakistan would have been offended. So I think there is a roadmap for achieving stability. And one way of doing that is this kind of counter-terrorism cooperation. But I think ultimately there has to be a political cooperation, political decision making. But right now we are not there. I mean, right now the civilian government in Pakistan is threatened by removal. And again, the civilian politicians in Pakistan are very openly blaming the military establishment for orchestrating what is essentially a court case and trying to launch a creeping coup through the courts. So the prospects of that kind of cooperation, I don't see them immediately. One other major thing to watch out is, of course, the U.S. strategy towards Afghanistan in particular, and that will also, of course, involve Pakistan. If the U.S. strategy, from what we know from the reporting, emphasize going after militant sanctuaries in Pakistan, then Pakistan will be in a very difficult situation and might be forced to change its course on Afghanistan. But I think that ultimately Pakistan will realize that peace within Afghanistan is in its own best interest. Pakistani society needs that kind of peace to function as a normal society, because in Pakistan we don't have one problem, we have many problems.
Final point, Hamid Hakimi, despite all these killings, endless tension between Pakistan and Afghanistan, everyone agrees that there has to be settlement. They must work together. So what has to happen to make this? Obviously, Pakistan has a lot to do, as Abu Bakr just mentioned, but also what Afghanistan can do to make this happen.
I think for me, as a young person, I'm always interested to see what could be done beyond the political realms and the top-down approach to relations. The state-to-state relations is also society-to-society relations for me. And between Afghanistan and Pakistan, a lot could be done from a bottom-up approach. Afghanistan-Pakistan shares over 2,000 kilometers border. It shares, as Abu Bakr was mentioning earlier, historical, cultural, religious links. So all of that could be unpacked and utilized for positive confidence building on both sides. For example, every time I've been in Islamabad and I've been with Afghans, because obviously I travel from London usually, it's just been so interesting for me to see how warmly the Pakistani university students would react to Afghan analysts and researchers, because for them, they still think of Afghanistan as some sort of Cold War ghetto. So for them to see that the society has changed, it actually gives them a sense of confidence, and vice versa, for the Afghans to come and see the warmth and the hospitality and society of Pakistan. With all its problems, of course, we have radicalization, we have all these extremist, trends going around society, partly because of economic problems and other issues. But I think the more we can open up the people-to-people relations, whether that's informal trade, whether that's real civil society exchanges, not NGOs, and whether that's media-to-media contact, whether that's having more formalized student exchanges, things like that. I think that will, over time, build a sense of confidence that would detox and hopefully remove this kind of poisonous view of each other. And then it will instill an incentive for the political class, because at the moment it's actually very politically convenient, both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan, to be anti each other. Because it actually is one of the best ways to mobilize people around, particularly in Afghanistan. You could say anti-Pakistan slogans and just hold a couple of placards in Kabul, and within hours you could probably get hundreds of people standing with you, agreeing with you.
Yeah.
So it's a very easy thing to do. But unfortunately, that's possible because people-to-people relations are almost entirely non-existent. So for me, that is the future. If we're going to follow a positive route to this, it has to be opening up more informal, more bottom-up and less political endeavors.
Thank you. Thank you, Hamid Hakimi, an Afghan scholar at the London-based think tank Chatham House. Also, big thanks goes to Sana Engel Rasmussen, Kabul-based reporter for The Guardian, covering Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. Gentlemen, thank you for your time and thoughts today.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's Pakistan and Afghanistan podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.